Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask you to smell the defendant.
Sure, like lawyers work in big skyscrapers and have secretaries. Look at him, he's wearing a belt. That's Hollywood for you.
Please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No. The defense is wrong.
Objection. Overruled. No. No, I strenuously object.
Oh, wow. Strenuously object, and I should take some time to reconsider.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 23. How you doing, Andrew?
Yeah, I think that that about does it for me too.
It's, yeah.
We have our usual intro in which I tell you I'm doing great, Thomas, but I don't know that I can. I don't know that I can muster that. I thought I'll put in a plug. You and I and Eli recorded an episode of Atheistically Speaking where, you know, we sort of decompressed from the election, and that that really did help in my view. Like, I thought it was pretty cathartic, and we had some fun. And I think anyone who's listening to this show who might want our sort of personal friends' reaction, I think would enjoy listening to that episode.
Yeah, certainly. I was really, really happy with that recording. Just had all kinds of everything that I wanted, which was just like Andrew's insight, Eli's humor, and just, you know, friendly conversation. It was really fun. So we thought that we were going to do a Q&A. I posted a status on our page, and make sure you're following on Facebook, Opening Arguments Podcast. You definitely want to do that, facebook.com/openargs, because if you didn't, then you missed out on the chance to get your questions answered here today, because President Trump has elicited a lot of curiosity among listeners, and everybody has questions for Andrew. I thought there would be some questions. I didn't know there would be about a billion. So we'll see. We've got a lot to do. A lot of people are looking to Andrew for peace of mind and legal advice here, which you shouldn't take from a podcast. But it's really cool. I also think it's incredibly cool that we have the opportunity to answer a bunch of questions that are on everybody's mind. So,
he who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Let's start with the first question to kind of get things started. And Rachel Marshall asked, would you share who you two voted for or your voting decision-making thought process? So I'm guessing people know who we voted for, but Andrew, why don't you go ahead and tackle that?
Well, Rachel, there are actually some comments later on the subthread. It's pretty obvious that Thomas and I both voted for Hillary Clinton. My thought process was this. I have been a Hillary supporter since early last year, early on in the primaries. I thought that she was running a very progressive campaign. I had posted throughout the primary season a number of articles about Hillary Clinton's actual record while in the Senate and her rhetoric since then. It's not to suggest that I don't have some reservations. And in particular, I had reservation. I think a lot of, kind of left liberals like me had some reservation at Clinton's hawkishness. And that was something that I expected to be fighting her from the left about while she was president, right?
Right.
And kind of pushing back on that. But everything taken together, it was a situation that, for me, I supported Clinton. I think, just to take one example, we talked about this in our other episode, but, there were a number of the Sanders key proposals, where I really do agree with sort of the middle approach, right? So Sanders' proposal was $15 an hour national minimum wage. The Clinton proposal was 12, and I agree with the Clinton proposal. Sanders' proposal was free college for everyone. The Clinton proposal was a series of policy measures designed to make college more affordable. I more agree with that. So,
yeah.
And I would say that those policies seemed, you know, I mean, if you want to call that moderate, right? Like, it's moderate between a liberal Democrat and a socialist. So, you know, yeah. I mean, we're not talking about triangulation and the kind of DLC stuff from the 1980s where Democrats were climbing, you know, all over themselves to be, you know, anti-gun control and pro-capital punishment and, you know, sort of all of that triangulation. I think Hillary Clinton ran a very liberal campaign. What I was most impressed with was, during the general election, her appeal to Republicans, now, I don't, maybe she should have done something differently, but her appeal to Republicans was a temperament-based appeal, right? Like she said, you're not going to agree with me on policies, but, you know, I'm smart and reasonable and you should trust me to be in charge of the country, which, you know, I thought was a good appeal, obviously. It wasn't good enough, but I think it's worth noting that unlike every other Democratic candidate in recent memory, you know, she didn't get to the general election and pivot back and, you know, sort of moderate out her policies and move to the right. I think that the
there wasn't any chance to talk about policies in the general. There wasn't even, they're just like, okay, well, do you care about these policies? No, okay, we won't talk about
it. Yeah, well, that's a good point. Okay, so that's my thought process. Thomas, what was yours?
Well, I agree with pretty much everything you just said. I think that it may come down to, you know, being a millennial. But I was initially supporting Bernie Sanders. The funny thing is, I actually feel the same way about most of what you said policy-wise. I didn't think free college for all is feasible. I didn't, like, I thought most of what he promised wasn't feasible. I just really, really appreciated his honesty. I felt like he was the most sincere politician that in my, you know, short 30-year life that I've gotten to really witness. Like, I felt like, okay, this guy believes what he says. He's lived what he says. He, you know, like all of that. And I don't know, something about, maybe I'm not alone because, you know, people in my the younger age groups tended to vote that way in the primaries. But I also think a lot of people my age and younger kind of buy into the super extreme progressive free college for everybody, $900 minimum wage, you know, kind of thing, which I don't necessarily buy into as much. But my thought process was, he's not going to get anything done anyway. It's going to be Republican Congress. So maybe I wanted President Sanders because his honesty, his integrity, and what he believes in, I think for the most part, I like what he believes in. I figured he'll try to get some stuff done. Maybe by the time, if anything gets through Congress, it would be a more moderate version anyway. So that was my kind of thinking. And then he lost, and it was, you know, and it was Hillary. And I wasn't thrilled. I was never thrilled about Hillary. But as it finally became clear that she would be running against the worst person to ever be a nominee for any party that I know of, it was pretty easy. It did not much matter what Hillary said or did for me, I'll admit it. I think she did a great job, particularly in the debates, but we were voting for someone with experience, someone with knowledge, someone who you could ask a policy question and she would be able to answer without using the word bigly and just saying tremendous and huge and terrible, like just fourth grade reading level sentences. So it was that versus a child who doesn't know anything and has absolutely no policy knowledge experience, and is a monster. So for me, it was really easy. And I think I'll try to resist going down the same paths we went on Atheistically Speaking. But the reason we did go down those paths is that I find it really interesting. And it's what's on my mind lately. So I'll just say, I'll cut it short and say, follow, you know, my social media. I'm battling it out a lot with people about what happened and where the votes came from and didn't come from and what, you know. And I think Andrew made an incredible point over on Atheistically Speaking, which was, votes aren't messages. At the end of the day, and you said this perfectly, Andrew, I think you're so right. At the end of the day, what happened? You have President Trump. I mean, that's what happened. No one gives a shit about your vote. No one's like, oh, did you not vote to send a message to the DNC? Okay, good. Well, you just have President Trump. That's all we have. President Trump and the harm and the disgusting, you know, nature of that, just grotesque nature of having someone like that as our president. That's what we have. No messages were sent. No one's going to translate the message that you intended as well. Like, they're not going to know specifically what the message was. It's just this vague thing that they're not going to figure out, and we're going to have President Trump. So for more on that, I'll try to stop going down that road, but it drives me nuts. But that was my thought process. I mean, it really was, for me, simple. I mean, we can't have this guy be president. Hillary is pretty reasonable. I also, to add one more quick thing, I found her, I all of a sudden found the claims that she's terribly dishonest and a liar and a criminal after listening to the Hillary email one, Hillary Clinton's damned emails.
I believe that's 13.
13.
That's
yeah, 13. I thought it was 13. After listening to that one and all that, I realized how much, now she's not perfect, obviously, but I realized how much of the supposed dishonesty and criminality I think really is not outright gender bias, but I think it's rooted in implicit biases that people don't want her to be honest, don't want her to be a good, you know, and I think that fueled a lot of weird conspiracy theories. And then once all these, the media covered all that, the right-wing media and even the mainstream media, it sort of became more believable, so people could just accept, like, yeah, she's the most dishonest politician ever. And when you look into those claims, there wasn't as much to it as I think you would think just from absorbing the media. So that was my thought process. I'm sorry, I was a little longer, but but yeah, that's, so I voted Hillary proudly, and I'm incredibly disappointed. Incredibly disappointed.
Yeah, and I agree with pretty much everything that you've said, including the reasons you supported Bernie in the primary, right? Like, I think it's perfectly reasonable to send a message during the primary, right? Like,
right. That's to when say, we, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there you go. So, and to say even, you know, I am voting for this person based upon character and integrity and sort of the intangible attributes. I respect that. I mean, I came to a different conclusion. I was not a Hillary supporter in 2008. I started off as a John Edwards supporter before all the craziness broke, and then became an Obama supporter. Obviously, I've been, you know, mostly happy with Obama as president. We could get into that.
Topic for another show.
No, topic for another show.
Well,
yes.
It will be interesting in January, maybe, or whenever, to do maybe a retrospective.
Let's do a retrospective. Yeah, let's put it on the calendar.
Yeah, that would be great.
And I became a Hillary fan over the course of the campaign. I was sincerely looking forward to her presidency.
Yeah, me
not
too.
Just, I don't want Trump to be president, which I don't want Trump to be president, but I was legitimately looking forward to it.
Yeah, question one. That was a bit of a long one, but I think it's a good setup for to know kind of where we are coming from. But even though that is where we're coming from, I trust Andrew that he's going to answer questions from a legal standpoint, not from a, but I think he does a great job, if I may say so, at showing where his bias is, but still answering the legal questions in the way that's consistent with his interpretation of the law. So that said, first question, and I actually think a lot of the questions, but I'll try to generalize this again, but I want to give JJ Bells credit for being the first to, I think, respond to our question-seeking status. Isn't he going to court for a rape case in December? What happens if he's convicted? And do we want to try to tackle all the charges against him at once, or wait till they come up in questions? What do you think?
So let me answer that and talk about some of the other cases that are pending. The first thing to remember is that the rape case, which is an allegation by a woman that when she was 13 years old, that she was sexually assaulted by Donald Trump, and the fraud case relating to Trump University, and these pending cases, even though they have elements that can be criminal elements, right? Rape is obviously a crime. Fraud can be a crime. These are civil lawsuits, okay? And think back to, you know, sort of the most famous dichotomy, you know, of the past 20 years, which was the O.J. Simpson case, right? O.J. Simpson was found not guilty for the murders under the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that applies in criminal law. But every time you commit a crime against someone, you also commit a civil wrong against them as well. Right. Usually it's not worth it to pursue any random criminal for a civil case because those criminals typically don't have the means to, you know, recompense you. And, it, you know, if you're going to spend $300,000 on legal fees, you know, people who have $300,000 to satisfy judgments tend not to commit crimes. They tend not to commit crimes of violence against people, right?
Yeah.
They commit white collar crimes all the time.
Yeah.
But so you can, right? Like if you're assaulted on the street by a random stranger, you can sue them in civil court. But you have to pay the cost of your own lawyers. And your burden, as we discussed in a previous episode, is only the preponderance of the evidence. It's the 51-49 standard. So the family of Nicole Brown Simpson was able to get a civil verdict against O.J. Simpson on that lesser standard, even though he was found not guilty on the criminal standard. So keep that in mind. All of these cases against Trump, even though they have like the rape allegation or the fraud, they're civil cases. So there's no criminal component to them. So now the question kind of, and a bunch of these questions say, you know, essentially, can he be impeached for the prior conduct before coming into office that are the subject of these lawsuits? And the answer to that question is probably not and no.
I was wondering that. Okay.
Right. It is to say this, right? Like a president can be impeached for the commission of high crimes and misdemeanors, as we saw with the impeachment of President Clinton in 1998. That term is undefined. President
Come
Clinton
on,
was,
lawyers. Right, I'm so tired of this. You just have a bunch of things. Oh, reasonable doubt. What does that mean? No idea, but we thought it was a good enough word to use. Defining things, would you guys?
Well, certainly things that are used in credit. I mean, remember, the reason why something has an imprecise definition is because, you know, you look to the case law and you look to the history to see how this has been applied. Well, you know, impeachments, we've only, you know, ever had two in our nation's history. So, you know, there's not a lot of precedent. But what we do have and can draw upon from the Clinton experience is that, you know, impeachment is whatever you can convince the Congress is impeachable. I think the literature is pretty strong and pretty persuasive that it applies to the conduct that occurs while you are in office itself, right? So, for example, even though there were allegations of prior rape by Bill Clinton before assuming office, and those resurfaced during this election, so I don't think we need to go back into them. There was pretty much agreement, even among Republicans, that Clinton couldn't be impeached for that, and rather he was impeached for lying in a deposition about the extent of his about having sexual contact with Monica Lewinsky. So what we can glean from that is two things then. Number one, there's pretty much agreement that you have to be impeached for what you do during your term in office, not what happened beforehand.
And it doesn't matter when the case is resolved. It actually has to be.
Right. Okay. It's the commission of the crime itself.
Okay.
The high crime and misdemeanor. And number two, and so, right. So,
well,
so
but
let
that,
me make
that's, it. So that's amazing. Cause like, it, what if it's just, I mean, I know this is a stupid Hollywood like level thing, but what, I mean, seriously, what if you killed a guy and then there was no evidence until you were in office and then they found some DNA evidence or something? Like, there's nothing. I mean, I guess you would just be convicted and the impeachment wouldn't matter. So that was a stupid question.
Well, you could have that, but you, and I want to talk
about
a
civil version of that, I guess.
I want to talk about that process, but it's pretty easy because the way in which that evidence would come about would be because there would be a congressional hearing. And so there would be at least one point in the president's term in which under oath, testifying before Congress, he would be asked, Mr. President, did you kill this guy? And he would say, absolutely not. Right. Yeah. And
what if he says yes? They're like, oh, okay. Well, there's nothing we can do. He was honest.
That would be a much more interesting movie for lawyers. It would probably be a much less interesting movie for everyone else. But yeah, if you had a president who, you know, got up on the floor of Congress, did you kill this guy? Yes. That would be really, really fascinating, because you would not have perjury, you know, during the president's term.
Wow. So would he be convicted and still be like president or something somehow? He's running the country from his jail cell.
Right. I think, and we're going to talk about removal of the president from office in response to a later question. So I want to save that.
Sure.
But the other thing I would say is impeachment is also controlled by whatever the Congress thinks is a high crime or misdemeanor.
Yeah.
And so, you know, think about this with President Trump. He's going in with a 24 vote. I don't know exactly what the margin is, but a significant majority of Republicans in Congress. Yeah. And so, you know, the idea that that those Republicans share the same view that our kind of left-leaning, at least question and asking audience does, I think is pretty remote. And the third thing I would add is, I'm not even going to say I don't know. Like, I think I am happier with a President Trump than I would be with a President Pence.
Okay, well, we could talk about that.
We get into that some other time.
No, that's okay. I'll take the opportunity, because I think you're going to be having to field everything this episode. That's something I've thought, because for me, and people who listen to my show will know how just depressed I've been about this. I really have been. But for me, the damage has been done for a lot of it. Not all of it, obviously, but if you take the package of President Trump as a whole, a lot of damage in my mind is merely the idea that we could elect him to the highest office in the land, and that he could say the things he said, that he could do the things he's done. He could not care about facts, all the stuff. I'll spare you, but all the stuff that he is, that damage to me is done. Like, even if he was impeached immediately, that part still remains for me. Like, I'm always going to be depressed that could even happen. And so then I've been thinking to myself, given that damage that part of the damage is already done, would I rather have President Trump or President Pence? And I'm honestly not sure. I think there's a higher risk to Trump, for sure. There's a higher risk that he just does something insane. We're at war with Iran or something. But I don't know. Like, there's also a pretty good chance that he just is lazy and doesn't really care about much. And like, it already seems like Pence is going to be running most of everything. So I don't know that President Pence is any better. So I'm curious. Actually, let me just ask you your opinion on that, if in case anyone didn't ask it. What do you think about President Trump versus President Pence?
I'm with you. I agreed 95% with what you were saying, right? Like, the damage is electing President Trump. And in my mind, the way to compound that would be have all of the problems of electing a President Trump that you've described, and then turn the reins over to a competent, dedicated right-wing ideologue who cares about passing things that Donald Trump does not care about passing.
Exactly.
And let's be, you know, look, we're bashing on Trump, and we're gonna have 2+ hours of bashing on Trump here. There are things Donald Trump has proposed that are good things, right? Like, the one thing he's emphasized since being elected is investing money into infrastructure to rebuild crumbling roads and bridges. Well, like, we're all for that. So, and we have a 20-year legislative history in which Mike Pence doesn't give a shit about that. So, you know, yeah, I would rather have the President Trump agenda than the President Pence agenda, even though both overlap on an awful lot of things.
Yeah, if it was just agenda, I think you're totally right. If it was just, let's take what, Trump says one thing one day and another thing 5 minutes later, but like, if we take what is stated, kind of do our best to figure out what his official agenda is, versus what Pence is likely to be. I think you're right. I actually think Trump might. What about the wall? Are they both in favor of that? I don't know. I mean, it might be. I think you put it well. It would be a good way to. It's like a sunk cost fallacy, where we really would just make it throw more good money after bad by having President Pence and making an effective kind of horrendous leader out of what might be kind of an ineffective one. So yeah, that's interesting. I agree with that.
All right, next question.
Okay, next question. Let's go with Adam Hutchinson. Hutchison. How easy and by what mechanism can he overturn the Obergefell decision and get rid of the Affordable Care Act?
Okay, so two questions in there. Let's answer the Obergefell decision question first, because we have a bunch of Supreme Court questions. And in my view, the way we talk about the Supreme Court being a 4-4 split right now, but that's not really the right way to look at it. The right way to look at the Supreme Court is it's a 4-2-2 court, or 4-2-1-1 court, actually. Okay. So there are four liberals on the court, right? Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, Stephen Breyer. We all know and we'll be doing everything in our power to prolong Ruth Bader Ginsburg's lifespan.
Yeah.
But so there are four solid liberals. There are two hardcore conservative activist ideologues on the court, right? Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito.
And then there's Scalia's ghost. Oh, no.
And they are in the Scalia mold. They are, in my view, interested in securing right-wing political outcomes on the court. There is Chief Justice Roberts, who is very, very conservative and has a conservative judicial ideology. But, you know, as we saw over the course, in voting for, in upholding the central mandate of the Affordable Care Act, I think Roberts, and this is a little bit of psychology, but I wouldn't put him in the same camp with Alito and Thomas, right? Like Thomas, Clarence Thomas gives speeches to Federalist Society groups, which I should say the Federalist Society is the pro-Scalia conservative legal club at law schools, right? And so all the like conservative kids join the Federalist Society and get together and bring in speakers who tell them, you know, how we're going to, you know, transform the law in this country. And Clarence Thomas is a regular speaker before those groups. He is an activist. And I think Roberts is a little more reserved from that. I think he has a little bit of the sort of more classic reserved view of the court as being an apolitical institution that should be set off from, you know, sort of the partisan rancor that goes on in society. Now, that may not make a huge practical difference if the court becomes, you know, a very conservative court. It didn't make an enormous practical difference over the past 6, 7, 8 years. But like I said, it did make a difference in terms of the ACA mandate. And he was somebody that I thought might moderate on a Supreme Court that I anticipated would get 1 to 3 Hillary Clinton appointees. And then the last person on the court is Anthony Kennedy, who has been much described as a swing vote. He is a right-leaning centrist, but Kennedy has been a very, very reliable vote on LGBT issues throughout his tenure. And just like when you look at political moderates, they're not always like, I'm in the middle on every issue. Sometimes they're like, no, I'm moderate because I'm very, very pro-choice, but I'm also very, very in favor of reducing the capital gains tax, right? And so that's sort of, you know, I've got one super liberal position and one super conservative position, and it balances out. Kennedy is, you know, a pro-business, small C conservative justice on the court. He can, he's open-minded. It's fair to continue to describe him as a swing vote. But under the current composition, I think there are 5 strong supporters of LGBTQ rights on the court. And again, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not in particularly good health. I think there's a real danger, and I don't want to undersell the danger, but I do think that it's not just 4-4 now, and it will be 5-4 as soon as Trump gets to appoint somebody. I think we've lost out on the opportunity. You and I talked about this. We talked about this at the end of the Second Amendment Masterclass episode, part 2, which has not yet dropped, but which we will re-release.
We'll release that soon. Yeah.
And I think there was some potential to maybe drive Justice Kennedy more to the left on a court that had appointees that were, you know, sort of more of the traditional school of jurisprudence that I've described over the show. You know, we've lost that opportunity, but I think his I think his view of the law with respect to equality for our LGBTQ friends is pretty strong. So I don't think there will be votes in the near term to go back and revisit Obergefell, because you're going to have five votes to reaffirm.
So in some ways, I mean, Trump doesn't really make a difference beyond obviously appointing the justice. It's not like he initiates the process of overturning a decision. So they have to decide, someone has to bring a case, right? If they decide the time is right and the justices are looking, you know, like they might be, if let's say something happens to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and there's a, you know, conservative justice appointed, it looks, I bet we have our five. That's when what? Someone has to just try to bring a case and go through the whole process again?
Right. And I am pretty confident that conservative legal groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom are looking for and or teeing up a test case right now.
But what does that look like for marriage equality? Is it like, oh, so two guys got married and it hurt me, so I need to sue? Like, how do you even, what is a case? This may be a dumb question, but is a case for that?
Right. Remember our discussion on standing, right? You have to be, you have to have standing. You have to be adversely affected by a government action.
My medical bills from dealing with having to know that two men or two women got married. I've been wronged. Like what? I really don't know what it would be.
Right. Well, you could have a Kim Davis style case, right? Like in which what you are essentially what you would do is you would move for a declaratory judgment at the trial court level that says, I want the court to declare that this issuance of a marriage license violates the Constitution. And the argument you would raise, we talked about the Rule 11 standard before, is I am raising a good faith. This is raised on a good faith basis that Obergefell was wrongly decided. And that's what I'm going to present on appeal. You would obviously lose at both the trial court and appellate court level. And then if there are four conservative activists on the court, right, you only need four votes.
You say you
to
would
grant
lose
cert
at that level because they would
because,
just say, well, the Supreme Court just
court,
decided
right.
this.
Yeah. A trial court cannot say, we're going to overturn Obergefell. A trial court would say, however much we agree with the plaintiffs or disagree, Obergefell is the law of the land. They're the Supreme Court. We're a trial court. We are a United States district court. And so their interpretation binds us. And you lose, and then you would appeal, and you would go to, you know, in Maryland, if you brought it in District of Maryland, you would, which you wouldn't because that would be stupid. you would then appeal to the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit would say the same thing, right? Which is, regardless of how we feel about X, Obergefell is the law. The Supreme Court's interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause controls. You lose, and then you would appeal to the Supreme Court. You would file a writ of certiorari. If four justices agree to take it, the Supreme Court takes the case, and that's how you get up to the court. So now that was the right predicate question, and I'll go back to what I was going to say before, which is assume that Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires from the court, and Trump appoints somebody in January, and then appoints a justice who's confirmed to take Ginsburg's spot, and conservative activists are saying, okay, we've got our five now. You still would have, this is where I made the point about Justice Roberts, because you still have the principle of stare decisis, right? At this point, Obergefell is a settled case, and the Supreme Court does not typically go back. I mean, we've talked about this. Most lawyers, regardless, you know, left or right, are sort of loath to go back and say, yeah, boy, that was just wrongly decided, and we overrule our prior holding and replace it with something else. It does happen, right? Brown versus Board of Education said Plessy v. Ferguson, which held that white kids and African-American kids could be sent to, quote, separate but equal schools. Brown v. Board of Education said separate is inherently unequal. We were wrong in Plessy, and that decision has been overruled. I don't know. Look, I don't want to say that there's a 90% chance, or, you know, there's a high probability that John Roberts would say, I'm not signing on to any opinion to overturn Obergefell. But I think that would be a powerful argument for him, right? I think it would be a powerful argument to say this is the law of the land. This is what the court decided 2 years ago. And let's not turn this court into an agency of, you know, right-wing policymaking by going back and saying there's no predictability. You can't rely on Supreme Court decisions because every time there's an election, there's going to be a new court. And, you know, I mean, that's the whole idea of the rule of law, is that the Supreme Court's opinions are durable. And you can rely on them for good or for ill, right? And so, you know, I was expecting when we did this episode that I would be fielding a lot of, like, how do we overturn Hobby Lobby? And how do we overturn DC v. Heller? And how do we, you know, and I was prepared to answer the question the same way, right? Which is to say, be careful about telling the Supreme Court, hey, you know, let's just go back and scrub this one out of the books, because there really is, you know, from a legal perspective, a value to stability and apoliticality, if that's a word, which it probably isn't. And I think that would have some appeal. Look, that argument would have no appeal to Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. They are conservative political activists. They don't care. But it would have some appeal to Roberts. It would have greater appeal to Kennedy. And so that's what I will be holding my hope out for if Trump gets to Supreme Court appointments.
Let me ask a couple quick follow-ups and their minds. I want to get to our listener questions more, so make them quick. But I'm curious, with something like the stupid Kim Davis situation, just the fact that they can ask for a declarative statement or whatever you said it was, so that wouldn't be hampered. Their efforts wouldn't be hampered by the fact that you could just say, hey, you just have to do your job. It doesn't matter what the law is. Like, they would still have standing to ask for, like, a declaration that gay marriage is wrong?
It would be you're asking a very good legal question. you know, I have not thought about the best way to design a test case to overturn Obergefell.
But it's so curious to me. That's fine. We don't have to get into it. But so funny to me is that I don't know what the hell that would be.
But so in my view, what you would do, this is why I said, it's why it's a good question. It's why I said offhandedly, it would be stupid to bring the case in Maryland, because what you would want to do, because if you brought the case in Maryland, right, a savvy U.S. district court judge would find a way to rule against the plaintiffs in this, you know, Kim Davis case, right? Ruling, without touching the issue at all. And the Fourth Circuit would do the same thing. And so, you know, you could find yourself with a really terrible record before the Supreme Court, which makes it a bad test case. So what you want to find is, and forgive me if I'm picking on a particular state here, you want to find a U.S. District Court judge in Alabama who's in your pocket, and then go from Alabama to the Fifth Circuit and ensure that they are going to tackle the question squarely and preserve a good record, because, you know, you want to bring this test case to the court. And let me say, I'm importing a little bit of a nefarious intent there. Liberal activist groups do this too, right? And if we were talking about a Hillary Clinton presidency and a Supreme Court that had moved, you know, sort of radically to the left, which would have happened, you know, you would be looking for people convicted of firearms offenses, where, you know, you would be bringing a test case and arguing that DC versus Heller and its progeny were wrongly decided, right? So I do not mean to suggest in any way that only conservatives do this kind of thing. Liberal activist groups do it too. It's how you have to tee things up, because our system says the Supreme Court does not issue advisory opinions. They only rule on live cases and controversies.
Right, right. And then I have some questions about the notorious RBG, and I'm let me go ahead and ask. I'm not sure if anybody got to it later in the thread, but I'm curious. Listener Thomas Smith asks, you mentioned her retiring. How does that work? What are the rules? Do they have to retire if a justice is I don't know, maybe her mind's not all there, maybe some condition, whatever. What's the point at which, I mean, I picture a scenario where she's just trying to desperately hold on for however long she needs to. What are the kind of the rules, or at least the typical procedures around that?
The answer is that under the Constitution, Supreme Court justices are appointed for life. They can voluntarily step down at any time. but there is no procedure in place to declare a judge mentally unfit or otherwise. You could impeach a Supreme Court justice. Oh. That's, as far as I know, that's never happened. But you could, under the same standard, you could impeach a Supreme Court justice. But other than that, you know, there is no provision. This is going to come up when we talk about presidential succession.
So even if, let's say, just hypothetical justice, I don't want to even pick on or jinx anybody, but a hypothetical justice starts coming down with Alzheimer's or something. I mean, and just can't really even rule on anything cogently, but they don't really aren't aware enough to want to step down. Like, there's nothing we could do.
Yeah, there's that. This again would make a pretty good legal movie for lawyers.
Right. Yeah.
There's not, you know, if that person did not voluntarily step down, if they couldn't be convinced by, you know, their staff and their clerks and their spouse and, you know, whatever. There's sure. really, there's no mechanism there. I'm going to talk about this when we talk about presidential succession. So, okay. Or I'll so we at can, least go back to it.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So we can move on. But thanks for that. I feel a little better. Like that there can't be any weird Republican-led effort to like declare RBG unfit or something if she's not healthy enough. Rachel Marshall asks, how much control does the president have over the military? Direct control / has to go through generals. So yeah, that's the kind of an interesting, might be a big question to tackle, but what can Trump do, generally speaking, with his generals?
Yeah. And here's the answer. And this is, we beat up on our libertarian friends a couple of weeks ago, or I think in just the last released episode. And I stand by that beating. If you are a libertarian and dispute, you know, feel free, send us an email, openarguments@gmail.com. I've answered a few of them, but so far I have not had any, had anyone sort of rise to the intellectual challenge we put out. That being said, an area where libertarians, I think, are right is the increased power that presidents in the latter half of the 20th century have had over the military. Because historically, the check on presidential power has always been that although the president is the titular head of the military, that only Congress has the power to declare war. And so the idea is you have to go to Congress to get a declaration of war. That prevents the president from just deploying troops wherever he wants. As you may have noticed, like none of the past wars, including the longest standing war in American history, which is the war in Iraq, which is still going on, are declared war, right? Like declarations of wars are kind of like judges wearing wigs these days. Like there will never be I feel pretty confident about this, a declaration of war the way there was at the time that the Constitution was written. And so this provision, you know, I mean, this isn't a good example of how the founding fathers were not wizards, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, they were thinking, well, obviously no country would ever send troops abroad without sending a formal letter written, right, you know, in pen and ink by quill upon parchment.
Yeah, because if you're going to send a bunch of ships and like sail the seas, the least you could do is write a nice little declaration. But little did they know how warfare would change over the centuries.
So what can Congress do, okay, to curtail the president's power to just send troops wherever he wants? They can do a couple of things. But again, let me give the caveat. We're talking about this is something that starts from Congress. And as we saw during the, in the aftermath of 9/11, when there was a democratically controlled Congress, members of Congress are elected every 2 years, right? They're essentially always running for re-election. I would say they are not typically what I would call profiles in courage when it comes to standing up to the president during wartime. And so even if we had a democratically controlled Congress, I would not be super confident that they would be aggressive in opposing military actions because, you know, our Democratic Congress rolled over for George Bush in 2002. And you can make the same for both parties going back. So that's not a one-sided political indictment. But that being said, Congress can do a couple of things. So number one, Congress can pass a resolution. They can pass a bill that makes it illegal for the United States to deploy troops to a particular country.
Really?
Right? Yeah. And they did that at the end of the Vietnam War with respect to, I want to say they're Laos or Thailand or something. I don't have a strong recollection of it, but yeah. So they can say no. The president has to remove troops from this area because it's illegal for U.S. troops to be in this particular area. But that, in light of what Congress did at the end of during Vietnam, they also passed the War Powers Act, which gives the president a particular period of time. I think it's 90 days to either seek congressional approval for a military action or withdraw the troops. And so the idea was that was passed so that you did not have the kind of brinksmanship that we've just talked about, right? So so typically when you talk about getting congressional approval for military action, you were talking about getting approval under the War Powers Act. And if they say yes, right, well, then what Congress has to do is repeal the War Powers Act. And to repeal the War Powers Act would require super majorities, because presumably the president, you know, if you're repealing the War Powers Act to force the president to withdraw troops, the president is going to veto it. So you're going to have to override the presidential veto. So that's number one. Number two, and you're going to quickly see the problem with this, the other way that the framers intended for Congress to serve as a check on presidential power to just sort of put troops wherever he wants is that Congress has the power of the purse and they could just defund the military. I think you immediately sort of see the problems with that, right?
Yeah, so, I hope it's that. Yeah, I can't imagine Republicans ever defunding the military.
I can't imagine any Congress.
Or even, yeah, sure. Even
right, because, you know, you would say, right, if the president says, well, I'm keeping the troops where they are, and then Congress says, well, we're going to cut their funding. And then the president's like, well, then you're going to have to explain to parents why they're, you know, men and women are coming home in body bags because they don't have sufficient equipment. That's not the side of the argument that you want to be on politically. And historically, you know, we have had arguments over funding about both the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan.
I mean, that's a little frustrating, though, because it's like, yeah. Couldn't they just be like, well, yeah, or you could just withdraw the troops. You know, it's like, it's not like, well, the troops are here and now it's your fault that they're dying because right, you're not funding them.
You could, but remember, you know, statistically speaking, it's twice as likely that the member of Congress is standing for re-election than the president, right?
And good point.
You know, if, you know, we have learned some things about Donald Trump's character over the course of the election, and I don't think backs down to threats is not something that I would say is a characteristic we have seen from him in throughout the campaign. So I don't have a strong measure of confidence that either of those are really a strong check. And, you know, so what? So again, if you want to be hopeful and optimistic, and I think it's always good that we try and inject some hope and optimism into our show.
if it's appropriate, I don't know.
You know, maybe that condition will cause bipartisan groups in Congress to get together and say, hey, look, like, let's figure out a way to curtail the expansive executive power to control the military, right?
Yeah.
For both of our sakes, because, you know, we're operating with scaffolding on top of a system that was designed in the 18th century that, you know, isn't really offering much protection anymore. And let's figure out a way to restore something that is consistent with the balance of power the framers intended, but reflects the reality of, you know, you're not marching your troops across the Rhine anymore. You're, you know, sending out carrier groups to, you know, a particular area or whatever.
Yeah, you're just like pushing a button and then a robot sends a missile and kills something.
Right.
That's interesting. It's scary, scary answer. It sounds like President Trump really, I mean, man, I've said this too. He really could go wrong if he wants to. Like, it's incredible if he put his mind to it how wrong he could go. I tend to, maybe let me just get a quick 30-second answer from you on a question of mine, because I've heard a lot of stuff from people all through this election and some bad arguments, in my opinion, of like, well, you know, the president doesn't have much power anyway. It's not a big deal. Checks and balances. I mean, how wrong in your view could it go?
I don't understand that argument. I just don't understand the argument that the president doesn't have much power, because historically,
heard it too, right? I mean, it's not just me. I hear a lot of people.
It's an argument that is completely untethered to history, because the president has never had more power than the president has right now. And we're going to talk about that in response to some of the upcoming questions.
Okay.
But let me say, this is not a legal answer, from a political answer. I am not overly worried about the, you know, sort of Trump pushing the nuclear button scenario.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of a tactical mistake by the Clinton campaign to sort of run the, you know, the modern Daisy ad and be like, you know, this crazy warmonger is going to get us all killed, because I don't think most people believe, and I don't believe, that Donald Trump is a crazy warmonger, right? Like I don't think he has, right? I would be concerned if he were Donald Rumsfeld, right? Like if he were somebody with a geostrategic view of the world that he wanted to impose, you know, Donald Trump doesn't seem to be that kind of guy. He seems to be the kind of guy who wants to make money internationally. And that's not really consistent
until somebody insults him. That's the thing that is the reason I think it could be a worry. Until a country, you know, provokes us or does anything like that, I do worry what he might do, you know, if Iran doesn't do exactly, you know, what he wants him to. But yeah, I also can't imagine we'll be going nuclear anytime soon, but I could certainly imagine conflicts popping up. But okay, let's give you a quick one. This is going to be an easy one, I anticipate, because it would be a crazy if the answer to this were yes. But Jared McKinnon asks, could he go to jail, which we already kind of covered? Could he go to jail for his upcoming fraud case? Also, could he pardon himself? I would hope the answer is no. Otherwise, I don't know. You know, I would think Nixon would have pardoned himself. So I'm going to guess the answer is no to that.
I think the answer is yes. There's no history on this, but I there is nothing, as far as I know, that prevents a president from pardoning himself.
No way.
So there you go. Now, he is not standing criminal trial for any charges. So there is nothing there. And remember that the primary impetus there is that a pardon is an admission of guilt. And so, you know, again, this has to go back to the movie script that we're writing, but I don't know. I'm happy to be corrected if somebody out there is an elections lawyer.
Why didn't Nixon do that then? Was it the timing of it or something?
Because Nixon insisted upon his innocence until the day he left office, right?
But he still got a pardon, right?
Yeah, he did. Gerald Ford pardoned him, and he accepted the pardon. But
he's
Nixon
like, I'm innocent. I'm innocent. Okay, I accept the pardon. I'm
Nixon
guilty.
Nixon was not going to pardon himself. The other thing to remember, I think this is worth going down a little bit. Nixon's Republican allies had turned on him by the time that he resigned from office. There was not the same level of, you know, sort of hyper partisan divide. There was nobody sticking by him. And I hate to say this about Richard Nixon, but like I think there was a sense of he could have pardoned himself, but that wouldn't have prevented him from being impeached and removed from office. And I think he didn't want that, right? And so, you know, there was no advantage, right, to pardon yourself, as opposed to, you know, when it comes down to the wire, to resign the presidency, allow Gerald Ford to take over and gain all those advantages anyway. That's why I think that happened.
Well, you know what, Jared McKinnon, I owe you a sincere apology. I guess apparently you can pardon yourself. I had no idea. I thought that was a silly question, but I was wrong. Sally Arthur asks, and we've kind of covered this, but maybe just to cover it from a slightly different angle. Sally Arthur asks, can he really reverse Roe v. Wade with the nomination of conservative justices, or should any of the liberal justices retire, and the help of the 30 states that he won? Now, how does that factor in? We don't really need the 30 states, do we?
Yeah. So the fact that he won in 30 states doesn't matter at all. In terms of overturning Roe v. Wade, I would answer that in two ways. Number one, by reference to my previous answer about the composition of the Supreme Court. And number two, that we are going to return. We did a three-parter on Roe versus Wade, which I believe is their episodes 6, 7, and 8, which was a lot of fun. And at the end of OA8, at the end of the third parter on Roe v. Wade, I teased the next development in abortion law, which is still contemporary today, which is Planned Parenthood versus Casey. We are going to go back and we are going to do that story. We're going to talk about it probably sooner rather than later. It's going to be a lot of fun. So this is not just a topic for a future show going in the hopper. Really soon, we're going to return to that. And I think you're going to find it really, really interesting. So that's my plug for future episode on Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Awesome. Eric Brewer, you know Eric Brewer, he's always got questions for us. Eric Brewer asks, I honestly don't know where to begin. So, okay. No, I agree.
Us neither.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. And I wish we had a better answer for you. April Poff asks, what changes are likely in the Affordable Care Act and what process would be necessary to make these changes? That's a big question, I think.
It's a big question. We don't. So the first half of the question, we don't know, right? The Trump has already sent mixed signals about what he intends to do with respect to the Affordable Care Act. As we know, the Republican Congress has attempted to repeal the Affordable Care Act something like 600 times since its passage. It's outrageous. But those were deliberately sort of impotent gestures, right? Like they knew that there was no chance that they were actually going to that was actually going to happen because you had a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president. So let me answer the second half. So we don't know is the first part. What's the process? Congress can, when Congress passes new legislation, they can describe how that new legislation interacts with existing legislation, right? So one of the constructions that they'll often say is you'll have a provision that says this law will do X. And then the next sentence will say nothing in any prior law is shall be construed as prohibiting or interfering with the ability of Congress to do X, right? So they'll say essentially this is superseding everything that comes before it. Sometimes they'll do the opposite, right? They'll say, this law is going to let you do X. And I'm sorry, I don't have an example here, but I think it's okay without it. And then the next provision will say, however, nothing in this act is intended to disturb the Civil Rights Act of 1964, right? Mm. And you do that because of precisely the sort of mainstream jurisprudential model that we talk about in just about every episode of Opening Arguments. It's a way of codifying what does Congress intend when they pass this law. And so when you read the words and a creative lawyer says, well, you know, this law says we're going to do X and that seems incompatible with this. So, you know, it could potentially supersede. Congress will often say, you know, whether they intend for it to do so or not. So Congress could, number one, pass a law that just strikes the Affordable Care Act from the books, that repeals it in its entirety. They could, I don't know how likely that is. It's less than 100%. Okay.
Yeah.
They could pass a new law that overturns critical provisions of the Affordable Care Act and explicitly says so, or you know they could just strike certain provisions of the Affordable Care Act. So one of the things that I would mention, and Thomas, you've heard me say this on social media, in my view, the provision of the Affordable Care Act that it's really important that we get out in front of on this and convince Republican lawmakers and conservative Democratic lawmakers, the Affordable Care Act ended prohibition on insurers discriminating against applicants on the basis of a pre-existing condition. Yeah. That's made an enormous difference for people in all of our lives, including, you know, my sister-in-law. And I know, and I've gotten messages and emails from people who are, you know, crying and hurting and really worried about that. And I would tell you, you know, get out and tell your story about that and tell your lawmaker, like, you know, forget the, you know, death panels and crazy stuff you've heard. The Affordable Care Act means that I can't be discriminated against on the basis of this crippling injury or disease that I have. And if it's overturned and I'm kicked off my insurance, then I will go back to paying $8,000 a month for medication and I will die. And
yeah.
if you go, and I don't care if your lawmaker is Jason Chaffetz or if your senator is Ted Cruz. Like,
your lawmaker is Jason Chaffetz, I sincerely apologize.
That but go into their office. You know, look Ted Cruz in his eyes if you can maintain eye contact, and tell him if
and
you
tell
vote,
me if he's a lizard or not. That's
and
what I,
tell him. But I don't want to lose this. Right, look sure. Ted Cruz in the eyes and say, if you vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act and insurance companies can discriminate on the basis of pre-existing conditions, I will die. And I'm telling you, not even Ted Cruz is going to be like, well, sucks to be you. Like, get out there, tell your story. Let's get out in front of this, because I think that's, in my view, that's something where I think we can mobilize people and we can save that provision. And I don't think that that's a liberal or conservative issue. But I will get off my soapbox now.
No, I think that's great. I really that made a lot of sense when you said it toward the end of a forthcoming episode of Atheistically Speaking. So, but yes, do that. So let me just clarify a couple things on that. In terms of what they can do, because April asked what's likely, in terms of what they can do, I mean, they really could do whatever they want, right? I mean, they can repeal the entire thing if they want, right? It's just a question of politically if they want to do that. Or correct. Do they need, is it because they don't have a supermajority?
Nope, they will not need a supermajority. All you need is a majority of both houses of Congress to send a bill that says, it would say SB1, a bill repealing the Affordable Care Act of 2009. And it would describe and would contain a copy of the text to be stricken. And President Trump can sign that into law. Okay. Now, can you block that by filibustering with the Democratic minority in the Senate? Yes, you can. Will the Democratic minority led by Chuck Schumer have the political wherewithal to filibuster literally everything coming out of the Republican Congress? We will have to find out.
Okay. But they can do that, though. They could filibuster, because I think that's what I was talking about, right, with the supermajority. They don't have a supermajority, so...
That's the cloture rule, right? That is the, it takes 60 votes to end debate. And so you essentially continue debate indefinitely on a bill. You have to end debate before you can formally vote on it. That's what we've seen over the past 6 years under President Obama with a Republican minority in the Senate that is more than 40 senators, where they have basically filibustered everything. And I know there's a later question on this, but we might as well answer it now, right? Like, again, this is one of these where, you know, a week before the election, I was getting a lot of like, you know, how can the Democratic majority that's coming in under President Clinton throw its weight around, given that we're not going to have 60 senators? You know, can we use the nuclear option? Can we get rid of the filibuster? Can we do X? Can we do Y? Can we do Z? And my answer, you can go back and look them up. Like, my answers were uniformly like, then a lot of these are on Twitter. But my answers were pretty uniformly like, maybe, but, you know, be careful what you wish for. Right. Yeah. And, you know, and I was thinking, you know, 4, 8, 12 years down the road, not a week down the road, but here's where we are. Right. And so, you know, the procedures that are infuriating when you have a Republican obstructionist minority in the Senate are the same procedures that are now available to that Democratic minority. That's what's out there. And so, you know, the more that you concentrate power and make it harder to do that, the more exposed you leave yourself when, you know, your party unexpectedly loses an election like this one. So
I think that should cover it for part one. We've got plenty more to talk about in part two. We got a lot more questions. I'm actually worried about getting through them, but if we don't get through them, maybe we'll go a little long in part two. But in part two, we won't have to talk about why we voted Hillary. So that'll give us a little more time. I'd like to say our patrons over at patreon.com/law will get access to part two early. Won't be instant. I do have to edit, do some processing and all that kind of thing. But I promise you it will be early, as early as I can get it, so that you can start coping with the election sooner and having your legal questions answered sooner than the non-patrons. We've got still more new patrons to thank. I'm blown away. Thank you guys so much. Patreon.com/law. Really appreciate it. I'm going to thank our new patrons, Rebecca Smelzer, Joshua Brown, Matthew Vernon, Daniel Murphy, Aaron Grady, Mason McAuliffe, Patrick John Graydon, And Courtney D. and Richard Heath, new patrons this week. Thank you so much, guys. We really appreciate that. I hope you enjoy the early part two when it comes your way, because you deserve it.
And as always, we want to thank our all-time greats, our Hall of Fame patrons. Those are Dan Irizarry, Eli Bosnick, Dave Nichols of the Positively Doubtful podcast, Dale, Steve Sigmund, Jim Grove, Desecrator, Patrick Fussell, Amanda Lipnack, La Bibliotecatrice, Heather Loveridge, Leon Hartley, Geeker41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Ali, Matthew Vernon, Hunter Ash, Michael, Kylie Reiser, Jeff S., Sakashite Fukasumi, ProPanic, Philip Stomberg, Zabby, Frederick Alstromer, and the Inciting Incident podcast. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the show at the levels that you've done to be Hall of Fame patrons. We really appreciate it. We couldn't do the show without the fantastic support that we get from everybody, and particularly from our Hall of Fame patrons.
Absolutely. And with that said, look forward to part two. Plenty more legal questions for Andrew to answer about President Trump. We'll see you then.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.